Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. 5 seconds for the last picture before the next session. That was a great picture. Good morning, everyone. Hope you rest a little bit after the wonderful dinner yesterday. I believe we had a great day, lots of valuable discussions, especially for us in the board. I would take this opportunity to thank you again to participate in, to attending and collaborating the exercises. This morning we'll start now this panel with Wayne Upton, the chairman of the IFRS Interpretation Committee and also our Director of International Affairs, and John Brom, Senior Research Manager with the ISB. They will conduct this session on cross-cutting measurement issues. We have 1 hour until 10 p.m. and if possible, we'll have time for questions and answers after their presentation. So please, Wayne and John.
Joan and I decided that I would speak from over here, she would speak from over there. You learn when you're in standard setting strategies for speeches like this. For example, I like to be on my feet because it's easier to duck. It's nice that we're separated because that means when you start to throw things, there's a 50% chance you might throw at Joan rather than me. When Mike Wells asked us to think about this session, we spent a lot of time trying to think about what the real issues were in measurement and what seemed often to be impeding our ability to talk to one another and, more important, to talk to our constituents. And as we thought about it, we said, well, you know, everybody thinks this and that's not true. Or everybody thinks this and that's not quite right either, but we seem to have a barrier. So what we've done for today is put together a collection of what we call measurement mythology. Those are things that many people believe, but that, like many myths, aren't true. And we thought we'd walk through some of those with you. As I say, I'm going to speak from here and bob and weave. Joan's going to speak from there, and I think, Joan, you're going to do the first mythology for us.
Morning, everybody. Wayne said, I'm on the IASB staff. I have been for years, but this is the first time I've come to a World Standards Census conference, so it's very nice to be here. As Wayne said, we're talking about various measurement myths. So it's not about measuring any particular asset or liability, but it is all of the things we're going to be talking about are one type of measurement, and it's all about measuring assets and liabilities by reference to future cash flows when these cash flows are uncertain, and so there's a range of possible outcomes. And lots of assets and liabilities are measured in this way. There's provisions, obviously. There's insurance contracts and other things like revenue obligations, performance obligations, when the consideration is variable, and even there, there's a range of possible amounts for the customer consideration. And the same questions always arise when you're thinking about measuring assets or liabilities by reference to the future cash flows. The first one is always, we've got a range of outcomes. Which amount do we choose within this range for measuring the asset or the liability? Because even if you disclose other amounts, you have to pick one amount for measuring, for the measurement purposes. And you could pick the maximum amount in the range, or you could pick the minimum amount in the range, or quite often you would pick some sort of central estimate somewhere in the middle. And the first question is, well, which of these do we go for? And then once you've done that, you have to think about discounting. You have to think about risk adjustment. Do we need a risk adjustment? And if we do need a risk adjustment, how do we measure it? And so these are the sort of issues that are arising across a lot of projects. And it's in this area that there are a number of these myths that Wayne was referring to. And we've picked on a few to explore today. I'm going to start with one that's particularly close to my heart, and that's to do with the term best estimate. There are a number of IFRSs at the moment say that an asset or liability should be measured at the best estimate of the future cash flows. But the IASB hasn't been proposing to use that term for future standards. And quite often people say to us, well, why? What's wrong with it? We know what best estimate means. And what better measure is there of an asset or a liability than the best one? And the answer is that individually, I think we all do have a clear view of what we think best estimate means. But unfortunately, we're not all thinking the same thing. I did a Google search on best estimate. And I found that there is actually a statistical definition. Statisticians would say that it's any statistical measure with minimum variance. But that's not what we accountants mean when we talk about a best estimate. And actually, what we accountants mean can be some various different things. Some of you would probably tell me that it's the most likely outcome. And in particular, you might think that if you're thinking of a sort of symmetrical distribution with the most likely outcome somewhere in the middle. Or you might be thinking of that when there are two possible outcomes, and then the best estimate is the more likely of the two. But other people, when they're thinking about more skewed distributions, would say, well, actually, the most likely outcome might not be quite right. We might go for something that sort of splits the distribution in half, which in statistical terms is the median outcome. 50% of the outcomes are higher, 50% are lower. In insurance accounting, quite often best estimate is used to mean the expected value or the probability weighted average of the outcomes, or in other words, the mean of the distribution. And then for quite a lot of people, it's none of these or any of these, because what they think of when you ask for best estimate is the amount that feels best in the circumstances. Because of all these different views as to what best estimate actually means, it means that best estimate isn't a good term to use in accounting standards. If we used it, we wouldn't be very effectively standardizing practice. And similarly, in your responses to our exposure draft, if you suggest to us that we use the term best estimate or that we measure assets or liabilities at best estimate, it's possible that we won't actually know exactly what you intend by that measure.
I think a couple of observations about this one. The big blue bubble in the middle is frequently how business managers describe the number they're trying to get. And you say, well, it's which of these other things is that supposed to be replicating? And they say, no, you don't understand. We're getting the number that we think is the best. And you can see the communications breakdown there, because we don't know how to judge or to even understand the assertion. Now, there's also a group that would say, well, you're taking away my professional judgment. You should rely on my professional judgment. And that's just not true. We're not taking away professional judgment. The ability to determine any of these numbers is going to require significant professional expertise, judgment, analysis, and all of that. But if we admit all of them as possibilities for the same measurement of an asset or a liability, then we have no comparability. We have no way of knowing that Ian did one thing and Paul did another and Sue Lloyd down here did yet a third, and what that means for the measurement. One of my old mentors used to say that judgment is how you aim at that target right there. That's judgment. Judgment is not deciding that, oh, I wish the target was over there instead, because that means that you no longer have comparability. Moving on, though, the second myth is that the IASB always, in these measurements, prefers fair value. Not true. And on this slide, we've put together a little list of existing and prospective projects in which the board does not prefer fair value. Provisions in IAS 37 are not a fair value measurement. There's been a lot of debate over exactly what they are, but they do not satisfy the notion of fair value that is in IFRS 13. They're a current measurement in that you have to update both the cash flows and the discount rate that you use in the measurement every period, but the objective is not fair value. When we move to the impairment of property, plant, and intangibles, fair value is one of the two pieces, but your impairment measurement is to the greater of fair value, or a second number that is not fair value, value in use, which again is a number that has nothing, has very little connection with the notion of fair value. So there it's a piece of the measurement, but not both pieces. The accounting in our current work on revenue recognition is not fair values. The insurance contract accounting measurements are certainly not fair value. Again, there's a desire to have a current measurement of the liability under an insurance contract because you want to reflect current changes in circumstances. But the result in that project, actually in the entire project's history, has never been focused on fair value as the measurement objective. And finally, in leases. Again, the measurement objective is not to fair value. So I think you can see that as we move through these, we as accounting standard setters have always done is we choose different measurement objectives and different ways of doing things that we believe provides first something that people can reasonably be asked to do, so that is a workable solution, and second, that provides decision useful information to the users of financial statements. It's made very clear to us that fair value is not the only decision useful piece of information. As you can see from this list, we change it up as we go along. Joan?
From fair value, we lead quite easily into expected value, because then some people say, well, even if it's not fair value you're asking us to do, you always say expected value, which is the probability weighted average of all the possible outcomes or the mean of the distribution. You don't consider that other possible measures, like the most likely outcome or the median outcome, might be easier to do or give us better information. And the board has put forward a number of proposals that involve expected value, but not in all of its projects, and it does give the other possible measures consideration as well. And for example, the latest proposals for revenue recognition, measuring variable consideration from customers, it wouldn't require entities to always use expected value. They would select either expected value or the most likely outcome, depending on which was going to give better predictive information. And I actually think that when you're trying to central estimate for the range of cash flows, it is important to consider which measure might be the best for the particular asset or liability that you're measuring. And in some cases, I think that will be expected value, and in some cases, I think it won't be expected value. And on the next slide, I've just put some circumstances where it could be that expected value is going to be the most useful and most appropriate measure for an asset or liability. And that will tend to be the case if you, the measurement objective is to estimate a current value of some sort, because any current exit value, whether it's fair value or value in use, it implicitly is measured taking into account all possible outcomes and weighting them according to their relative likelihood. So if the measurement objective is a current value of some sort, then it makes sense to consider expected value. And similarly, if the transactions recur frequently, expected value is a measure of the long-run average outcome. So if you've got a transaction that's recurring frequently, expected value could be the most predictive measure of the ultimate amounts that will be paid on settlement in the long run. Thirdly, users might be concerned about the outliers, and the outliers are the more extreme but less probable outcomes. And users might be concerned about them in particular if they're big losses like debt defaults or insurance losses from catastrophic events, say. And in this case, expected value is the only central estimate that takes into account all the possible outcomes, including the outliers. So if the investors are particularly interested in the outliers and in changes in estimates of the outliers, then expected value could be a good measure then. Expected value is widely viewed as being more difficult to estimate than other measures like the most likely outcome. And certainly, to get to an expected value, you have to identify all the possible outcomes and their relative likelihood in order to measure the average. But in some circumstances, it can actually be less complicated to get to an expected value than some of the other measures. And that's because there are some properties that the expected value has that means that it's an easy number to work with. For example, you don't have to worry about unit of account, because whatever unit of account you use, the expected value ends up being the same, which isn't the case for the most likely outcomes. And similarly, if you're grouping cash flows into intervals, whatever interval width you use, you end up with approximately the same expected value, which isn't the case with the most likely outcome. So although in some circumstances expected value is more difficult to measure, that's not always the case. And one particular situation in which the expected value might be the easiest amount to estimate is when the variability in the cash flows isn't just in the amount of the cash flows, but also in the timing. So that rather than a row of different outcomes, you've got a sort of matrix, in which case picking the most likely amount or a median amount from within a matrix can be quite tricky, and measuring the most likely the expected value can be easier. But that's not to say that expected value is going to be the best measure in all circumstances. I've got a few where I think most likely outcome or median outcome could well be better. And that will be particularly the case if your objective isn't to measure a current value, but to predict the future cash flows, and the transactions don't recur frequently. And it might be that there's only two outcomes for a transaction that's a one-off transaction. And in these cases, you may well say that the more likely outcome, or if there are a few outcomes, the median outcome, is the one that's going to be most predictive of the future cash flows. And these other outcomes are the ones that don't take into account the outliers, which might be better if the outliers aren't so important to investors. And they might be less important in a variety of circumstances. For example, if the outliers are a remote income stream, investors might not want companies to put too much weight on very unlikely income streams in measuring their assets. Similarly, if the outliers are for some reason more difficult to measure reliably than the more central estimates, again, the investors might not want too much weight put on the extreme outcomes. And in these situations, the more likely the Muslim might prefer the asset or liability to be measured on the basis of the most likely or the median outcome. And then we have to take into account these situations where it is easier to identify the most likely outcome or the median outcome, and investors don't get significantly better information from expected value. They can get just as good information from the asset being measured at the most likely outcome with disclosure of the other possible outcomes. So I think overall what we're saying here is that expected value isn't a panacea, and the board doesn't think it's a panacea for everything, but it does have its uses and could be right for some assets and liabilities while not being right for others.
Thank you, Joan. To reprise a couple of the observations that Joan just made, because I think they're especially important. Expected cash flow is not a principle or a rule. It's a technique. It's a wrench or a screwdriver or a hammer. If it's a hammer and you're not driving nails, it's the wrong tool. And as Joan said, we need to match the tool with the objective of the measure. Expected cash flows is a better tool when we're doing valuation, when we want to come up with something that values an asset or liability, whether it's fair value, current value, settlement value, whatever. Because it allows us to think rigorously about the situation. In particular, if we're confronted with a situation in which timing is uncertain, as Joan said, you cannot do anything else. There is no single interest rate that allows you to value a cash flow that is uncertain as to its timing. Finally, there's the question of, God, you want me to do this, I have to run 55,000 Monte Carlo simulations to be able to determine this. No, you don't. Three might be enough. Some circumstances, two. What we're asking you to understand is, what is the mean outcome? You need to do as much work as necessary to understand the mean, and you need to do as much work as necessary to understand, as Jones said, the dispersion around the mean. You don't need to do any more work than that. And that gets us into this question of, well, matter of fact, I've jumped ahead, haven't I? How do I think about a range of possible outcomes? Well, one important point is that you have to think as hard about the median, or the middle point, as you do about the mean, or the average. To think rigorously about the median, as Joan has pointed out on several occasions, is actually just as hard as doing expected cash flows. And so when we talk about, for example, an accounting standard, something like more likely than not, which is usually thought of as an attempt to find the median, well, that means that you need to understand all of the things that are either leading up to that point or decreasing down from it. And so it's just as hard to think rigorously about a more likely than not than it as it is about an expected cash flow. Again, you don't need to make this harder than it needs to be. And I think we need to recognize that in all of this, when we're dealing with estimates of future cash flows, the possibility of error and disagreement can be very wide. So devoting a lot of time to getting your expected cash flow number down to 5 decimal places probably isn't a productive exercise. When your disagreement, possibly among different people doing the same judgment, is 5 decimal places on the other side of the decimal point. So it's necessary to do exercise, I think, a little discretion in this. This slide I won't go through with you in detail. It's a simple computation of how you might approach an expected cash flow problem in practice. 3 possibilities. I don't know how to assign precise percentages to them, and so I start out by talking about them in the terms that we would often use in talking with one another. Best case is 100, that's what I hope happens. It's probably more likely that it's going to be 200, but I'm still not sure. And an end of the world or a tsunami outcome would be 1,000. And then we take that and we attempt to translate it into a number that we can actually compute. One of the common objectives is that the result of that number is none, the result of the computation, is none of the 3 possibilities. And that's absolutely right. And that's a good example of why, if the accounting objective is predictive information, as it is in revenue recognition, this may be the wrong technique. But if the accounting objective is valuation, as it is in provisions, impairments, financial instruments, any of those things, then 250 is the number. It's the value of these 3 possibilities taken together. Joan, over to you.
I've recently been working on the project which is to update IAS 37, the provision standard. And as some of you might recall, the last exposure draft proposed some measurement requirements for the new IFRS. And these were that the cash flow should be measured at expected value and adjusted for risk. And we got lots of comments back from people who said, we don't get this. We don't understand why you would ask us to do expected value and add a risk adjustment. Because surely when you're measuring expected value, you're taking into account all the possible outcomes, and so you're taking into account all the uncertainty. Why would you go and add a risk adjustment on top? And the answer is that although the expected value takes account, measures the average of this spread, it doesn't measure the size of the spread or give any indication. And I think the best way to illustrate this is with a simple example, a really simple example. Suppose you had 2 different assets. Asset 1 has certain cash flows of 500 currency units. Asset 2, you're not sure what the cash flows are, but you reckon it's going to have 50% probability of 250 and 50% probability of 750. Well, what we can instantly tell about these 2 assets is that they have the same expected value. And so if you were just measuring its expected value, you would put the same value on these assets. But what the expected value here isn't taking into account is the greater variability in assets. And what the risk adjustment does is that it adjusts the pricing of the asset to take into account the fact that a risk-averse entity would put a lower value on asset 2 than it would do on asset 1. Now, that doesn't mean that you always have to have a risk adjustment with expected values, but it explains why, in some circumstances, you might have a risk adjustment with expected value. And this has come up on the IS37 project, but it's a question that we get asked whenever we talk about expected values with risk adjustments.
Before I turn to the next one, there is a school of economic thought that says that a rational person ought to price those two the same. A lot of economists, especially at the University of Chicago, have won a lot of prizes for that. Any of you want to take those two assets for the same price, knowing what you know about the uncertainties? Okay, you win a free ticket to the University of Chicago. The rest of these folks are going to say, I'm going to want something on the table for that uncertainty. This next one is one that's a little hard to quite get your mind around, and we need to be very careful about being very precise with our language. Here's what we all learned when we went to university and studied finance. The greater the risk, the greater the interest rate. But interest rates are in large part the price that the market places on risk. That is true under two limiting conditions. First, it's true for assets, and it's true when we talk about the interest rate that is applied to the contractual cash flows, or in the absence of contractual cash flows, the most likely cash flows. Typically, this holds true under those limiting conditions. The problem happens when we move to liabilities. And let's think now about a risky liability with contractual cash flows. But in the contract, the cash flows can vary. And so if we flip back, now, instead of being two assets, they're two liabilities, one of which might cost me as much as $750 or as little as $250. And when you do the arithmetic, what you find is that when you change your perspective from an asset to a liability, and you attempt to talk about a discount rate compared to either contractual cash flows or some kind of certainty equivalent cash flows, risky version makes the discount rate lower. Why? Because in order to assume that second liability, I want more cash before I'm willing to accept the liability. And when you do the arithmetic, more cash doesn't translate into a lower discount rate. It translates into a higher discount rate. So the arithmetic and everything that we're accustomed to thinking about flips when we move from talking about thinking about risk and risk adjustments in a liability and risk adjustments in an asset. Now, if Ian and I are in the same market and we're negotiating between one another, we're going to arrive at a price that satisfies both his risk position and mine, or we aren't going to do a transaction. That's fine, except if there were observed prices, we wouldn't be having this discussion because we'd just use them. But we're not. We're trying to think systematically about how to do expected cash flows and valuation and about what the impact is of thinking about risk when we try and put our traditional equations together. And this is one where it does work against some people's intuitions. But I think it's been pretty well demonstrated arithmetically. And finally, the admonition at the bottom of the slide, especially when we think about liabilities and uncertain liabilities, things like fixed asset decommissioning costs or environmental remediation costs or things like that, trying to do cash flows and then find a discount rate that is somehow justifiable probably is the wrong answer. Looking for the right discount rate typically isn't as rigorous in this liability space as we like to think it is in the asset space. And so we're left with having to say, well, we're not going to pick a discount rate. We're going to discuss it in terms of how you go about computing the discount. That leads us to questions, but Amaro is on his way up here. And does that mean we're going to take your normal approach to questions? Anybody got one? No? Thanks. We're out of here. We got, what, 15 minutes?
Yes.
10 minutes? Okay. I thought he was going to throw us out. Questions, reactions, discomforts. We've kind of hurried through this. Some of this is kind of not the stuff you want to do first thing in the morning. But.
Or maybe you can come up with some myths of your own to add to our list.
Come on.
Wake up. Yeah, Ian.
Wayne, isn't risk adjustment just prudence by another name? And shouldn't we then be telling Tim Bush?
That's two questions. The second one I will pass. For those of you who know Mr. Bush, you would also pass. Ian's question isn't risk adjustment just another word for prudence? And there's certainly that risk, and in which case you would want to do it, would you? Except that if we're trying to think about how marketplace participants behave, and if we look, rather than to the University of Chicago stuff, to the behavioral finance stuff that says that in our little example, let's flip back to that. It turns out that people worry much more about the 50-50 than they do about the 100, as evidenced by my jocular question to the room. And you're right, that's irrational in one definition of the term, but it's also observed. So I don't think it is just prudence. I think it's attempting to refine the measurement. Yes, Clement.
Thank you, Wayne, and John for that very constructive presentation. I'm just wondering, you know, in your presentation, you also mentioned that on the feedback from constituents, there are a lot of questions on the conceptual angle of how come you are asking for that kind of value, that kind of adjustment, and things like that. And what you just did was very informative. I just wonder, to go forward, how do you think that could be more meaningfully disseminated to the group?
Joan, I took one. You take one.
Well, it's nice to hear that it was informative, and I think you're possibly right. Personally, it's taken me some time to understand where people are actually coming from, because it's not always articulated in the same way, and so it's taken me quite a long time. I've worked on a variety of liability projects, and it's gradually, and measurement type projects, and it's been gradually that I've come to understand that there are these pervasive views that are causing the difficulties in communication, and it's as much our fault as well from making assumptions about what other people think. We hopefully are getting better at communicating these things, and in particular on the reasons for and against using expected value. For example, we have written a paper that we are trying to disseminate and talk to people about.
Yes, of course.
You mentioned about unit of account when you talk about using estimated values. I didn't understand the first relation between unit of account and variation method.
Yeah, it was a bit of a technical point, actually, but it's all to do with the three statistical measures, mean, median, and mode. And out of these, the mean, which we would call expected value, has got some interesting properties, and one of them is this one that's called linearity, so that if you measure the mean of a single item and measure all the single items mean separately and add them together, you get the same number as you would do if you grouped all the items first and then measured the mean of the group. And that's an interesting property for accounting, because it does mean that you don't have to specify a unit of account for measurement, which can be very good if you're trying to figure out whether it should be portfolios or individual assets and liabilities. And you don't get the same effect if you're looking at the most likely outcome or the median outcome. The median of an individual asset, add them all up for all the individual assets, won't be the same as the median outcome for the group as a whole. Easily best illustrated with an example, actually, but maybe you can take my word for it.
I think there is one dimension to that that you may have put your finger on, though, Akul, and that is that if the unit of account means putting more things that are similar to each other in. So we're assembling homogeneous accounts receivable or something like that, credit card receivable. What Joan said is certainly true. Or insurance contracts, as long as they're all the same kind of insurance. Once you start mixing things in a unit of account so that the things have different characteristics, so that they're no longer what the statisticians call independent events, then I think you would find, obviously, the unit of account could change the number because you've all of a sudden put things that are not like each other together. And I think, Joan, am I correct on that, that in that circumstance you wouldn't necessarily have linearity?
It depends. You still get the linearity if they are
dependent
on the same. If they're dependent on the same event, you can still get the linearity. But there must be a point where you start adding up apples and pears and it all falls apart.
Yeah. Yes, in the back. I can't see from the light. But.
Yeah. Yes, thanks. Wayne, thank you for helping to complicate interview process for employment. It's simple to just ask someone seeking for a job, please differentiate between best estimate, fair value, and expected value. That will, cripple the applicant. Now, did I hear you correctly when you said best estimate will no longer be used in future standards?
Well, I think I said that.
Okay.
What I was saying was that we are trying to avoid using it because of the problems that it is too vague a term. And although it might mean most likely outcome, or it might mean something else, it's better to say exactly what you mean than to use the term best estimate when it's not clear to everybody what that means. So that doesn't mean, we're not saying that we would never use most likely outcome in a standard. We're just saying we probably wouldn't say best estimate without then being more specific about what best we intend best estimate to mean.
Okay, I'm Pius Maneno from Tanzania. For the way you have talked, the same slide you are using, you have said expected value may need risk adjustment. That means it is no longer an expected value. Maybe you should find another name. Because if you say it may need risk adjustment, then you cannot call it expected value. Because it is another value, maybe fair value, maybe another name. Because we are contradicting each other.
It is a good point. We always get tied up with that in drafting, trying to make sure that we don't say expected value when we mean risk-adjusted expected value. Thank you.
There are actually very, very few measurements in accounting that are done based only on cash flows. It's almost always cash flows and usually present value. So that's no longer expected cash flows either. That's the present value of something else. And we have found this notion of working with expected cash flows, a risk adjustment, and then an interest rate that doesn't need to worry about those other things as a useful way to approach a variety of problems, but not the only one. That's it.
Yeah, thank you, Wayne. I'd like to ask about risk adjustment. What do you have explained about this concept of risk adjustment? Are they applied to insurance contracts? Because supporters to the composite margin approach, they are saying risk adjustment are not really fairly evaluated, and it's not so clear what is a risk adjustment. But according to your explanation, we may not need to worry about that because there are so many clear, concepts here.
Yeah, that's certainly a hot topic in the insurance project, isn't it? Whether or not in that particular project you need a separate risk margin. In the insurance project, both the FASB and the IASB have reached the conclusion that there should be no profit on day one. As a consequence of that conclusion, you have the expected cash flows reduced to a present value, and then the question is, what's the piece that's left over? The IASB board, by a split vote, said, well, we think that leftover piece has two elements. One is a risk margin. The other is, to use a very technical term, a plug. It's just the number that it takes to get to zero. The FASB position in looking at that was they had a lot of discomfort about the computability of a risk margin, whether or not it actually had an objective reality. And some also said, and if you're just going to plug the difference anyway, why worry? So they voted, and I don't recall whether it was a split vote or unanimous, it doesn't really matter, that they preferred to just deal with that piece as a single thing to be dealt with in the account. The difficulty, let me give you two extreme cases. In one jurisdiction of which I am aware, I am told that the margin piece of applying this standard would be roughly 60% of the premium. That's a big, big profit margin, but it's a unique market. In that case, I don't know how interested I am in trying to be real precise about the risk piece because there's so much there. On the other side, think about a contract that's written at the very edge of profitability. And a risk margin is the difference between whether or not it is a loss contract that has to be recognized immediately or a contract that remains profitable for accounting purposes. And so at that extreme, a risk margin starts to sound real important. if it's the difference between whether we have an onerous contract or one that isn't onerous. So it's the issue isn't really, I don't think, straightforward. It's more difficult. Kevin, I'll get you last, but down here to Canada first. Gordon.
Thanks, Wayne. One of the things that we see in some of the standards measuring liabilities is the expression that the discount rate should reflect the risks inherent in the obligation, or similar words. What the heck does that mean? Because our experience is when you talk about dispersion, the dispersion of interpretations of that term is extraordinarily wide.
It sure is, and I don't know.
I agree. I've always struggled, and when I've been responsible for IAS 37, it's the sort of question I've always dreaded. But it is one of the reasons why I think that it's one of the things that needs to be sorted in IAS 37, and in particular at the moment, because it isn't clear in IAS 37 whether it should be taking into account non-performance or credit risk or not. And if you're looking at a liability that's extending 40 years into the future or something, the difference can be absolutely enormous. So whatever happens to IAS 37, I think that's something that we do need to sort.
Okay, Kevin, I saved you for last.
Thanks, Wayne. And the challenge to find a new myth was the one that got me going. So out of this session, my myth for you is that the IASB is now prepared to be much more expansive about measurement methods at the same time as it seems to be much less willing to talk about measurement attributes.
Fair point. I think that is a description of where we have been going, certainly in our recent deliberations. We've been admitting a number of things that don't fit the traditional list of measurement attributes. Okay, none appearing. Amaro's going to throw us out. Over to you, boss.
Thank you very much to Wayne and John. And I take this opportunity to thank all the presenters that contributed to our conference this year, and I ask you to join me in a big applause to both of them. I have now a number of notes here, all prepared by Mike. So any error or mistake, please. Well, first I would like to thank you all for attending this year's conference, and not only attending to be here in London, but also participating in our exercise. We have almost 50 countries representatives here today from various organizations. So we have account standard setters, we have regulators, we have observers that are from the private sector. So I guess this gathering is one of the most interesting and valuable for us in the ISB to perceive what's going on out there. So thank you very much for coming to London. Thank you very much for attending this year's conference again. Then I would just like to take this opportunity to commend our team, our education team that organized this venue, and I'm personally always amazed how much they achieve with such a small team. So please, now really with a big applause to Mike Wells, Gloria Linfield, and Janet Smy to provide us such a wonderful 2 days gathering. Thank you, Mike. And some of you will be shortly with us in our conferences in the U.S. and in Brazil. We'll meet together in early October in Boston or in late October in Brazil. Some of you will meet again, Mike, Wayne, and others in SME trainings around the world. But also, some of you, we expect to come to see again next year in the World Standard Center. Next year, tentative date is end of October, 25th and 26th, a little bit later than usual because of the side effects of the Olympic Games. So we hope we'll have the opportunity to see you again next year. Now, I just would like to mention that you have the breakout sessions after tea. Tea starts ends at 10:30. The breakout sessions on some important issues as well. You would identify your name in the board outside this room, and then you just go to the room associated with the team. The rooms are, as you know, upstairs, one floor up. And I took note here of something that I just would like to get your attention again to, the question that was raised yesterday by Paul Cherry from the IFRS Advisory Council on the IFRS adoption. Please do provide the reply to that question. The two questions that we put yesterday here, send an email to John Baldur. I guess this is the last gathering. We'll be all together today. You still have lots of things to work. So I take the opportunity to again thank you and wish you all a safe journey back home, but only after this afternoon sessions, please. Lunch will be served as yesterday in the foyer after this first breakout session. Afternoon breakout session will be in the same rooms. Please, again, identify your names in the board. Thank you very much. Have a safe journey back home.